Hello and welcome to this Innovation Forum podcast. A few weeks ago, Innovation Forum's Toby Webb spoke with JTI's International Affairs Director, Elaine McKay, at our Ethical Trade and Human Rights Conference online. They talked about agricultural supply chain child labour issues, the importance of recognising the complexity of the challenges, and the need for agri-sector businesses to get to know their suppliers.
So, Elaine, do tell us a bit about yourself and your career, and then we can move on to talk about the work you're doing at JTI in this important area.
Sure. So, my name is Elaine McKay. I am Swazi by birth, South African by nationality, and I live and work in Switzerland at the moment. I have, for the longest time, geared my career towards the development or not-for-profit sector. So I've worked in education systems, in understanding how we moved in South Africa from an apartheid-based education system to one which was democratically free and respectful of people regardless of their race and gender, for example. Then I moved into HIV and AIDS and spent a significant amount of my career trying to help understand why people knew so much about HIV but didn't really change their personal behavior to reflect that risk. And one of the struggles I encountered in that space is that it's almost impossible to raise money to do the right thing. Donors are available, but they'll tell you what they want you to do. The private sector interested me because they know they have challenges and are prepared to invest behind those challenges. In the context of HIV, it was making sure that their workforce was tested, that their workforce had access to treatment and care, that their workforce was protected, because if you lose staff by death or long periods of absenteeism, there's a business case for doing it. And that's why I like being in the private sector. And I think at the moment, it's the perfect place to be when you realize what's exactly happening and the role that you can play in changing the environment.
Certainly, it seems the private sector can be more mobile and has more direct drivers to do things quickly. And of course, that more direct connection with sourcing and farmers on the ground enables you to move quicker, comparative, of course, to other institutions. Given we have more time, why don't you start by framing the challenge of child labour in your industry? Because not everybody will be familiar with the intricacies of the tobacco sector. I'm guessing predominantly in Africa, but also elsewhere. So it'd be interesting to hear from you just to frame the challenges as it currently exists, and then we can move into talking about how you've been tackling that through various programs and some of the issues that arise from that and opportunities.
I work for a company called Japan Tobacco International, and tobacco is at the forefront of what we do. What is interesting is that we employ around 45,000 people. We operate in more than 120 countries, and some people recognize our brands before they recognize the company. But a few years ago, I think in 2009, our company realized that in order to be at the forefront of our company, we needed security of leaf supply. If you imagine you're dealing with an agricultural commodity, a storm, some kind of climatic event can significantly interrupt that security of supply. So JTI made the decision to purchase leaf dealers and what we call vertically integrate. What it took, though, was JTI, who was largely a procurer of tobacco leaf, so we would buy the supplies that we leave, the manufacturer of leaf and distributor of tobacco product, it became now much more about the grower. We bought companies that gave us a footprint in Africa, as you can imagine, but we also buy a lot of leaf in the US, Brazil, and actually the footprint for leaf is more than 33 countries, so from Southeast Asia all the way to the US. When we got so close to the grower, we realized that the outside world sees our employment not at 45,000 people, but see the grower as our employee also. The duty of care, as people defined it, was frightening because people said we were responsible for the grower. But the grower is contracted to us. We don't have an employment contract with him. We have a contractor agreement, which he undergoes in order to grow the leaf that we need at the right quality and at the price that is good for both of us. But it means that we've virtually doubled our employee base from 45,000 to more than today, 45,000 directly contracted growers. So if you imagine a world where people think that a farmer is our employee, how much more do they think we are responsible for? At the same time, the world was changing and the UN guiding principles were being ratified. And these principles were saying, well, you don't need to just know what's happening in your factories and in your manufacturing footprint. You need to know what's happening in the second and third tier of your supply chain. That took us, again, right back to the grower, having to know at a much deeper level which are the challenges he's facing economically, environmentally, and in terms of labor. And the UN guiding principles say that you mustn't just know what your issues are. You need a plan to fix them. And anyone that participated in the last 2 days of the conference will be very clear that more and more, the UN guiding principles are now being embedded in national action plans. So in the Netherlands, for example, has embedded in their law compulsory human rights or mandatory human rights due diligence insofar as the rights of the child is concerned. And that's what companies like ours are now responsible for. So the first message is, if you procure an agricultural commodity, you have a problem with child labor. That's one of the lessons. You don't need to do human rights due diligence to understand the scale of the problem. If you're buying cocoa, sugar, tea, anything that comes from the ground, you have a problem because you have a problem with labor. And when you run a factory, it's fine. You can control access. You can control and verify age, because if they're on your payroll, they'll give you an identity document to prove who they are. On the farm, it doesn't work in the same way. Yet the expectations from the UN guiding principles and the law are becoming more and more aligned. And that's the challenge. When you deal with an agricultural commodity, someone has to harvest the crop. Labor is a challenge, and that's why child labor is so pronounced. Child labor is an issue in agriculture, and that's one of the key messages that has to come out here.
So an interesting follow-up question for that. In the previous session, I was going to outline the worst human rights dilemma I'd seen poor farmers facing as an example of the complexity of the issues. And for me, the most difficult dilemma I've ever seen families facing were stories I heard of when I was in West Africa, Northern Cote d'Ivoire, families from places like Burkina Faso, there were lots of children, effectively selling children into slavery on cocoa farms across the border in order to keep them alive because the harvest had failed. They knew they couldn't feed their children. I mean, that's the worst ethical dilemma I've ever heard anyone had to face. They'd actually interviewed some of the children on the farms. I mean, CNN actually did a big documentary about it 10 years ago. One of the more in-depth ones I've seen media do. Normally it's kind of, you know, blame the brands. And the children were being interviewed and saying, well, you know, if I wasn't here working as basically bonded labour on a cocoa farm in Northern Cote d'Ivoire, I probably would have starved to death. And the stats indicated that north of the border. That's one of the dilemmas that poor families face in the cocoa sector. Admittedly, not in every part, but in some areas. And I wondered if families in tobacco are facing those kind of really stark economic choices, or whether the issues are less challenging than that, but they're more kind of endemic in the culture of where they are. So just maybe you could give us an overview of, not the worst examples, but the kind of challenges that poor farmers are facing and the choices they have to make that can lead to some of these issues happening in the supply chain. Just kind of bring it to life a bit.
Absolutely. And what you're describing is understanding what the root cause of the problem is. And that's what we pay a lot of attention to in our fight against child labor, because otherwise you're putting a plaster on a band-aid. You have to understand what is driving children to seek work in hazardous conditions in agriculture. Two of the root causes we've discovered, one is poverty. People are poor and they want to make sure that they can eat. It's as simple as that. The other one is culture. So the means to deal with both of those root causes is completely different. If the root cause of child labor is poverty, you need to make sure that people earn enough money to send their kids to school. You need to replace income that was lost when a child is now at school. In terms of culture, you need to change the way people think about children. In Brazil, for example, the biggest sustainability issue is kids don't want to be farmers. So they leave Rio Grande do Sul and move to São Paulo or Rio because they're looking for something else for themselves. Now that poses a challenge. And in Brazil, you cannot work on a tobacco farm if you're under 18. So farmers are more inclined to use their kids because they want their kids to love the land. Both approaches require dialogue. Both approaches require us working with community members and farmers specifically to help them change the way they see children. Because it's not just about saying, here's $100, go to school for the year. How is the child going to eat when you've taken that income away, for example? What kind of support is available to the child? So what we do is embed the rights of the child in direct contracts with growers, so they are aware what our standard is. That's the first thing. Our standard, though, is very clear, but we will not cancel the contract on the first occurrence of child labor. When we've identified it, we then work with the grower to change the circumstance for that child. Because as you say, for many kids, you will leave them worse off. You leave family members worse off if the contract is simply cancelled. That's not a viable strategy. What we've also discovered is that when you do due diligence, that is done the correct way. You listen to the rights holder. So often due diligence is done sitting in a beautiful office in Geneva or Stockholm. And it's just a tick-the-box exercise. Yes, we've done it. The risk to the business is high. Climate change, labor issues. No, that's not the way it works. You have to have conversations with rights holders. And when you listen to them, it's easier to come up with solutions that will benefit them ultimately. So in Malawi, a farmer says to me, education makes you poor. I had never heard that before. Because kids go to school because parents believe the return on investment will come. I went to the school. There's more than 200 kids in a class. The teacher is ill-equipped to teach 200 kids. Often no electricity, no running water, 40 degrees outside. That's what he sees.
It's a minimal learning environment, isn't it, really, at best?
Absolutely. So what our strategy then encompasses is withdrawal of children from child labor and then making sure that these kids are actually attending a school that's safe, empowering teachers, building the capacity, and actually building and refurbishing schools so that you can reduce that pupil-teacher ratio.
If you look at a lot of smallholder agriculture, we spend a lot of time in other commodities wringing our hands about how young people don't want to stay on the farms, but then also wringing our hands about child labour. Where do you draw the line on definitions here? I'll give you an example. I heard years ago, and this may have changed, that the minimum legal age for working on family-owned farms in the US at one point was 11 years old. And when I was 13 years old, growing up in rural Somerset, I was driving a tractor and I worked in fields when I was 13 or 14 for piece rate, picking fruit and vegetables. That's what we did, because the only other job was McDonald's, and we'd much rather be out in the fields earning tax-free money. It's very easy to get caught up in the sort of media hysteria about what is child labour, but when you talk about embedding the rights of the child into contracts, how do you work with the cultural challenges of defining what is a child in an appropriate context?
Very good question, because I was 9 years old when I could pick and bale cotton on a cotton farm in Swaziland. The key difference is it didn't interfere with my ability to attend school. And that's the difference between child labor and child work. It's embedded in our contracts and specified by age, and we get our age ranges from the ILO's conventions on minimum age and the worst forms of child labor. And in fact, what we say in our contracts is that our standard will prevail even when the law offers a lower standard of protection. So you're right. In the US, on family farms, 13-year-olds are driving the tractors. And if you go up to the farmer and say, your child shouldn't be doing this, it's like, who do you think you are telling me what my child can and can't do? But that's, in our contract, that's hazardous work for a child. When they are legally able to work, when they are appropriately trained and protected, then we can discuss whether or not a child can do hazardous work. So the first thing you do is make sure a farmer understands the difference between child work and child labor, because we're not trying to tell them how to raise their children. You know, I have two kids. My 16-year-old has to contribute to this house by cleaning and cooking. They mustn't now all of a sudden discover that that is hazardous. But it doesn't interfere with their ability to attend school. And that's key. It must not interfere with their health and morals. So we're very clear. Where the law offers a lower standard of protection, our standard is clear. No one under the age of 18 should be involved in any hazardous activity unless the law allows it, they're appropriately trained and protected. And in some cases,
How do you define non-hazardous? Because if I go back to the cocoa farm example, I remember going to these fair trade cocoa farms with Cadbury first time I went 10 years ago. And people are sitting there, young people, young women, cocoa pod in one hand, machete in the other, bang, open it up, get the seeds out for fermentation, flesh goes for whatever purpose. There were some journalists there and the people at Cadbury were going, oh no, they're not supposed to be doing this. They're supposed to open the cocoa pods with a stick because it's hazardous work. And all the villagers just burst out laughing and said, have you ever tried to open a cocoa pod with a stick? we could, A, you can't do it. And B, frankly, we wouldn't make any money if we did. And that was a really good example of some of the dilemmas, I thought, of how you define hazardous work. And some of the challenges were exemplified through that for me of how you actually tackle that in a rural community. So when it comes to your own example, and how are you defining hazardous work as it applies to children?
We worked with the ILO. We worked with our toxicologists and scientists to come up with our lists of hazards so that a farmer understands what we deem to be hazardous. One is carrying heavy loads. So we don't use machetes to harvest tobacco, fortunately. That's a good one. But you carry heavy loads. Mm-hmm. And comparatively speaking, I mean, we have a range. So the bag should not weigh more than 10% of the child. For example, I even check my own kids' school bags to make sure that they're not carrying heavy loads. Working at heights is a hazard. Working at night is a hazard. So what we've specified is very clear in the contract. So the farmer understands what we deem to be a hazard. There are those who think, for example, that all work with tobacco is hazardous. That's not the case. There are some activities that kids can do as long as it doesn't interfere with their ability to attend school. So they can, for example, help out at home. They can mow the lawn. But we do not want kids carrying heavy loads. We don't want kids operating heavy machinery. We don't want them working long hours. And we definitely don't want them working at night.
Let's talk about then how successful that is on the ground. I'm guessing a lot of your smallholder farmers are not terribly well off given the environments they're operating in. Tobacco is often a higher value crop than many others, so they might not be the region's poorest farmers, but they're not making loads. So how do you get that across on the ground? And are those kind of approaches seeing results? Do farmers listen, I suppose, is what I'm saying. And what evidence do you have? How do you kind of monitor the fact that they might be listening or not?
So, Toby, they wouldn't listen to you. Who do they listen to? It's our leaf technicians. So we have one leaf technician for every 100 growers. And they are trained on good agricultural practices. So the farmer knows the quality that he needs to grow to fetch the highest price. In addition to good agricultural practices, we've taught our leaf technicians to observe labor practices, health and safety standards on farms. They're now able to ask workers whether they have freedom of association, as an example. We've taught them how to observe child labor. And that's an interesting one, because it's easier to see a child on a farm. You can differentiate simply by size between an adult and a child. And then to have a conversation with the grower, to say, this is in violation of our standards. Why is this child here? Mm-hmm. Farmers are beginning to understand that if they send their child to school, they can employ adults to work. The quality of the leaf is better. Because I don't know, people listening, if you have kids and you tell them to go and bake, your kitchen is a disaster. Children working in an area does not necessarily deem quality. So farmers are realizing good agricultural practices plus good labor practices, mm-hmm. better quality. Better quality means better price. So you're right. The price paid on tobacco is much higher than any other food crop. So that's their cash crop. And they want to make the most money so that it can allow them to pay school fees, buy machinery and equipment. And the stories, even though they're smallholder farmers, that we get are incredible. Malawi, when we started, their yields were 600 kilograms per hectare, doubled without changing now the size of the land. How do you do it? Good agricultural practices and good labor practices. So they see the return on investment.
But that's a monitoring aspect, really. If we think about our title of monitoring and remediation, your leaf technicians are a key monitoring technique or a key monitoring element. But
and they come from the community. They know the grower.
To each farm, then, because if someone said to you, all right, how long is it going to take you to visit 100 farms? It'd be quite a while, wouldn't it?
I mean, if you're farming in the US or the UK, when the farms are so large, when on average they half a hectare to 1.5 hectares, they're very densely populated. I mean, they're very close by to each other.
I walk from one to the other, I guess.
On your motorbike, exactly. But these leaf technicians will visit on average once a month over the crop cycle. We also know when you're more likely to have children on farms. It's during harvesting. So you can intensify your visits. But what we wanted to do was implement a Japanese philosophy called Kaizen. Continuous improvement. So this is not about naming and shaming. It's knowing and showing. So we have reports, for example, you find that the inspectors will arrive on a farm. You find flip-flops, but no children. Means they've kicked them off and they've escaped. They've run away so that they're not found on the farm. Our leaf technician comes from those communities. They have conversations with the growers all the time. And then in conjunction with our program to fight child labor, if the leaf technician system is not working, the ARISE system kicks in. And ARISE is our root cause-based approach to fighting child labor. We train community members on how to identify and monitor child labor, making sure that those kids are in fact going to the schools where they said they were going to. It's not just us doing it on our own. It's working in conjunction with other community systems to make sure that they are there when we are not there.
That's a lot of the monitoring covered. Let's talk about remediation before we talk about collaboration. Your monitoring is pretty clear and sounds impressive, but let's say you find a problem. You don't want to kick them out. What is the typical objection that the average farmer might have to following your protocols? Is it purely economic or is it also deeply cultural?
Depends on where you are, again. So Brazil, generally culturally, and Africa, largely financial related. So we have a dedicated program for child labor specifically that we call ARISE. and you can find it on ariseprogram.org. This program operates in Malawi, Zambia, Tanzania, and Brazil, and focuses on fighting the root cause of child labor. So it has three legs, if you like. The first is the law, and this is where this is important. The law must protect the rights of the child to be free from child labor. The second one is education and awareness, making sure kids are at school and their educational outcomes are improved. The final one is income-generating activities or economic strengthening, replacing the income that's been lost. So those three pillars together is a root cause-based approach to fighting child labor. These are embedded in the community. So remediation means if a leaf technician observes child labor, we can then absorb that child into an ARISE program that is best designed for them. If they're 16 or 17, we can't send them back to school, but we can offer them vocational training. If they are 5, 6, or 7, we can put them at a school. We can make sure that they get access to textbooks and school uniform as example.
So the obvious question is, where are the gaps in your supply chain? Because if you look at the number of tobacco farmers supplying the tobacco, the big majors, it's enormous, isn't it? It's a huge number of smallholder farmers. How much of your supply chain is covered by what you've just described?
Almost all of our vertically integrated operations is covered. So where we directly contract, we're more or less covered. Where the challenges are is where we don't buy directly. So you're buying through another leaf dealer in another country. So what we find is there's not uniformity of approach when it comes to fighting these kinds of issues. And it's the same for cocoa. It's fine if they all give money to the International Cocoa Initiative, and that is their means to implement. But if Mondelez is doing their own thing, Barry Callebaut is doing their own thing, Nestle is doing their own thing, it can cause a problem. Because how do you add it all up if it's not consistently being applied? And that's why ARISE is interesting in those countries. And what we're working with our third parties to make sure that similar approaches are being implemented so that it is cumulative. What we find, though, is a challenge is we do an area-based approach. Okay, so you have these growing communities. That's where we deliver ARISE. The school investments, everything is done at community or area-based level. But if we're not talking to other commodities, a child can leave our farm and walk onto a tea plantation or fruit plantation who's not following similar standards or approaches. And again, this displacement causes problem because this child is still in an agricultural supply chain, not ours anymore. So we need much more collaboration, not just at commodity level or shared commodity, but also at an area level. I'd love to know what others are doing in sugar. I mean, cocoa is not grown in conjunction with tobacco, so that's not really an issue. But in a country like Tanzania, where multiple crops are being grown, there has to be space where you can share what you've learned and what you're doing so that governments can better report on their fights against child labor.
We have an ongoing research initiative looking at exactly this, looking at palm, cotton, coffee, cocoa, and we're working with a number of organizations about that. So I'll send you some information about that.
Great.
If you might be involved, because you're absolutely right. You know, it's the overlapping Venn diagrams don't overlap enough. And even within some of the trading houses, they can't break down the internal silos. You know, if you do coffee, you do coffee, that's it. The palm guy is over there and the soy people are over there. It's a real challenge.
And this is the thing. Child labor, comparatively speaking, is the easy one. Because it's easy to convince your chief executive why you need to fight for the rights of the child. Absolutely. It's easy to talk to communities about their kids. Let's talk about freedom of association, bonded and forced labor, health and safety. Those conversations are more difficult. So I see child labor as the starting point. In the same way that COVID shows you what's not working, child labor is a similar lens. Because if you have problems with child labor, then there's often other violations. Of course, they might not be endemic the way child labor is, but it's the conversation starter.
Yes, absolutely.
And now more and more, private sector is going to be liable. Governments are going to be facing serious financial issues post-COVID. Private sector is going to be responsible for everything.
When it comes to the 50% that you don't have direct contracting with, how confident are you that those farmers ultimately in that supply chain have any kind of similar program available to them? And do you see that as an area that you'll want to expand into? Or do you see the solution as just going 100% direct contracting at some point so you have that traceability down to farm level, which is what every soft commodity producer or buyer is talking about these days?
So number one, our standards are the same whether you buy directly or indirectly. So they have to subscribe to the same labor practices standards as we do. The issue on variation comes on remediation, where there's no consistency in how that is being applied. Now, I don't know of any company that wants to be 100% vertically integrated, because then you can't balance your risk.
Yeah.
You know, if we have a flood in Malawi, we can pick up that percentage somewhere else. But if you're fully integrated, the risk is huge.
Yeah.
So we do have more control in our VIs, but the standards are the same. So what we need to work towards is similar approaches in fighting child labor and other labor issues, so that the remediation standard is the same.
Yeah. So how do you get that visibility then? If you don't know exactly who the farmer is for 50% of your supply chain, what needs to change for you to get that visibility? Is it going to be technology enabled? Would you call the other 50% sort of a mass balance kind of approach? Maybe I'm using the wrong terminology. But what I'm trying to get at is, what are the solutions for getting to the visibility? So you can say, okay, we're only 50% vertically, we're only 50% contracted, but the other 50%, we know where it's coming from. Is that an objective? And how will you do it?
We have very good line of sight of the provenance of our leaf. All of our contractors, whether directly or indirectly, we've geo-mapped all of the farms. The labor practices observations are coming across all of our operations. So technology is very useful. And I swear, even our smaller leaf dealers are doing amazing things. The big problem is remediation. It's not understanding their growers. They want to know who their grower is because they need to go and fetch the leaf when it's grown. That's not the problem. The problem is fixing the challenges that the observations are showing you. And how can those be done consistently in a non-competitive way?
What's the answer then? You must have been thinking about this a lot. How is it going to happen? Is it collaboration between the big buyers? Is it an equivalent of the ICI for tobacco? What's the solution, or the mix of solutions you might think will tackle that?
We do have an ICI for tobacco called the Eliminating Child Labor and Tobacco Growing Foundation. And that we all put money into it so that it can sort of catalyze activities and events that are similar to our ARISE model, root cause based. The problem is to get to scale requires significant resource. Significant. Because this is the UN guiding principles, eh? You need to know where you have it, you need to remediate it. And people see remediation as paying for it, which is not the case. Remediation means you need to put someone back to the situation that they were in before their rights were violated. You need to make sure that you offer a policy commitment not to make that violation occur. But fighting child labor requires significant resources, because it is about addressing the root causes. So it's not just running a campaign.
It needs the industry to put more money in.
I think it needs to work smarter with the money that it is putting in. We need to address this like it's not a competitive issue.
I mean, is smarter going to be enough?
I don't know. I think the world is going to show that they are leaders and that they are followers. And the aim is to bring the followers up to the leadership position. Because ultimately what's going to happen then is the multinational, they are going to tick all the boxes. They're going to comply with all of the regulations, but the small and medium enterprises are simply not. How do you then manage your risks when your small and medium enterprises are not contributing at all?
Well, this is the same in palm oil. It's the same in cotton.
Is the thing. This is the bottom line, Toby. It's got nothing to do with tobacco. It's an agricultural supply chain. And how do we make sure that the supply chain is sustainable from a human rights perspective?
Take the one rotten apple out of the barrel, right? Because we know what that does to the barrel. So, Elaine, let's talk about collaboration. We're there already, but I'm thinking about the questions we were discussing in preparation for this session around sharing learning and lessons, and about some of the more granular things like data sharing. We probably can't get through all of them. What do you see is necessary in terms of sharing more learnings? Is it that needs to happen first more in the tobacco industry? Or are you suggesting, or do you believe, that there's an opportunity to collaborate now with other agricultural commodities? Or is that kind of running before you can walk?
I think the learnings in the tobacco sector are good. And if you look at tobacco, in fact, exceeds expectations. We've won an award for our fight against child labor, for example. I think there needs to be more learnings across commodities. But we also need to create an environment for the sharing. A lot of CEOs are very scared to talk, or for their people to talk, simply because they're scared of the legal risk they're going to face. And that's the storm that's being created. So investors are demanding more transparency. The UN guiding principles want more transparency. With more transparency, higher legal risk. The lawyers will tell you, don't say anything. Don't get involved. Because the less you know, the less likely they are to sue us.
That defence is an old one, though, isn't it? Things have moved on from there.
I don't know. Every time I go to the UN to one of these 3-day sessions on business and human rights, there's an awful lot of lawyers there.
Okay, interesting. Do you think there'd be a reticence from other agricultural producers outside tobacco to want to work and share with you because of the reputational challenge? I mean, I would call it cowardice in the sense that they would be terrified that the anti-tobacco NGOs would jump on their backs and accuse them of legitimizing. Do you get from your informed sessions with other industries that that would be a challenge?
I don't know. You know, we benchmarked our approach to child labor monitoring against the ICI's approach. And I think it's easier when you're not growing the same geography. With COVID, for example, we've arranged calls with sugar, tea, and others to understand our agricultural response to COVID. So I think that there is space for that conversation to happen. It's just taking too long for it to happen organically. I have not faced lots of criticism from the private sector about our commodity and what we sell. The criticism comes from the health lobby and the anti-tobacco lobby, not from the private sector.
Yes, I just wonder if the private sector might be less willing to collaborate with you because they're also paranoid about their brands being tarnished by association with tobacco.
I suppose that is always a risk. But I mean, if you're going to do something and you want to do it well, best you learn from the experience of those who've been doing it for 10 years.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's the challenge.
I completely agree. I guess we'll find out in the coming years. How advanced are the conversations about landscape approaches? We hear in other commodities, thinking particularly Latin America, Southeast Asia, we're seeing this idea of the landscape approach taking hold, jurisdictional approach taking hold. There are certain projects around the world that are trialing this. And you can call it production protection. You can call it preferred sourcing destination. There are different ways of looking at it. I wondered how far that thinking has penetrated in your industry and what's happening in that space. You talked about working by geography anyway, so it sounds like you're almost there.
No, fortunately, because of the different varieties and grades of crop that we buy, we do have quite a significant geographical footprint. If you compare us with cocoa, for example, that can buy in 2, maybe 3 to get the supply of cocoa that it needs. Oriental leaf doesn't grow on the African continent. It grows in places like Turkey, in Macedonia, for example. So we don't have any kind of protectionist mentality. What you want is the best quality leaf at the right price. And that's more of a conversation. Fortunately, governments are realizing how important the agricultural sector is. So they're paying more attention to their growers. They're making sure that the law is more protective. It's just such a long journey, Toby. I mean, it would be ideal if governments played their part so that the private sector wouldn't have to do everything. It would be great if the countries could afford to build schools so that we don't have to. But that's not the case. And there is this sweet spot where the rights and the needs of business overlaps with the development needs of government and overlaps with the right holder. That's the sweet spot that you have to find.
Are there any examples you can cite of where the tobacco industry or your company is collaborating with other agricultural commodities to help drive up overall standards in a geography or region? That's the landscape definition for multi-commodities, although it is very difficult, and I wouldn't say anyone's doing it particularly well.
It is very origin specific, and it depends very much how much government is driving it. So we've got some interesting examples in countries like Malawi and Zambia where we can even match commodities where farmers are growing more than one crop. So you can get a viable market for another product that they're selling. But it's in its infancy.
I think we'll leave this one here. And Elaine, we shall be in touch to be
Definitely.
Continued.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Toby.